This is Hybrid Teaching, Pedagogy, People, Politics, a serialized audiobook addressing the intersections of pedagogy and power in our connected and challenging education environment. It's the audio version of the open access collection of the same name, published in February 2021. The book features 27 chapters of provocative text addressing the intersections of critical pedagogy and digital technology in our present political moment. I'm your host, Chris Friend, from Kane University. I introduce your authors and read the occasional chapter. This podcast provides one more avenue for accessing the material from the book, which is also available as an ebook, a print-on-demand paperback, a series of articles published on the open web, and screen and print-ready PDFs available for free on Hybrid Pedagogy. This is Chapter 5 of Part 3, Politics, and you'll hear Disowning Tech, originally published on the 8th of September, 2016, on Hybrid Pedagogy. It is read here by its author, Timothy R. Amidon.
Education is big business. In the U.S., over 5% of gross domestic product is earmarked for education. Student debt in the United States is estimated to be over $1.2 trillion. The educational technology market is worth over $8 billion. Certainly, a great deal of economic value circulates within and through educational systems. However, schools and colleges also create forms of social, cultural, humanist, and civic value. In a hybrid pedagogy CFP, Chris Friend challenges educators to interrogate, quote, how critical digital pedagogy can add to or ensure the value of an education, end quote. Foregrounding the critical role that autonomy plays within learning, Chris gestures tacitly toward the decreasing level of agency that those most directly involved in learning have in defining the processes and purposes of education on their own terms. He writes, teachers must choose to create classes and schools wherein students actively create their learning environments and control their own progress, end quote. My interest was piqued. Like Chris, I share a concern for critical hybrid pedagogy and view the purpose of education as, quote, human enrichment and increased consciousness, end quote. As an intellectual property scholar, an associate editor with Kairos, a journal of rhetoric, technology, and pedagogy, a member and former chair of the IP Caucus of the Conference on College Composition and Communication, and now an associate professor at Colorado State University, I spent a good deal of my early career learning how ownership impacts the type of intellectual property that is created and consumed within schools and universities. Through this work, I've come to realize that decisions regarding ownership in educational systems are always decisions about the following six things. First, who will and who will not control and define the learning process? Two, who will and who will not profit from the ways that learning processes are enacted? Three, who will and who will not have access to science and scholarship and the infrastructure necessary for creating it? Number four, who will and who will not participate in the design of curriculum and assessment in learning spaces? Number five, who will and who will not profit from the benefits of science and artistry? And number six, who will and who will not have opportunities to attend schools and colleges? Thus, while I strive to enact a critical pedagogy that is built around the type of self-actualization that enables students to realize the civic and humanistic aims of education, I often struggle to achieve the level of autonomy that seems necessary for this work because authority over and ownership of education has been distributed to a wide variety of stakeholders, many of whom seem to frame the purposes and value of education in purely economic terms. Within my home institution, for example, we might sketch a network of stakeholders that consists of government sector actors such as elected officials and the Colorado Department of Higher Education, public sector actors such as taxpayers, current and potential students, alumni, donors, and private sector actors such as local and global businesses that employ CSU graduates, student loan financiers like Sallie Mae, designers of tests like Advanced Placement and CLEP, learning management systems like Instructure's Canvas, educational technologies or iParadigms Turnitin, as well as databases like ProQuest and EBSCOhost. A network perspective not only lays bare the various stakeholders with a vested social, economic, and political interest in what happens within schools and colleges, but also the ways that agency for what happens within classrooms at my institution extends beyond the students and educators charged with constructing learning. Cultivating environments for agentive learning occurs within educational systems where ownership is increasingly distributed, so students and educators who see the value of humanistic civic education must do so while negotiating the multiple competing aims promulgated by other stakeholders. Consequently, it's productive to not only think of schools and colleges as sites of learning, but also as marketplaces where goods, knowledge, and services are consumed and produced. It's reasonable for private, public, and government sector actors to be motivated in different ways. However, there is a fundamental flaw when educational systems, however distributed they might be, place the aims of individual profit and privilege before the humanist and civic aims of education. Value is created in educational systems that equitably expand the wealth of human knowledge through science and artistry, produce workforces that can participate within economic systems that create the knowledge, goods, and services that societies consume, and prepare students to participate fully and meaningfully as citizens of a democracy. Unfortunately, the civic and humanist aims of education, those of greatest consequence to us collectively, seem to be those which are most readily obscured by and subordinated within current political discourse surrounding education in the United States. Too often, this discourse reduces, or seeks to reduce, our schools to businesses, and education to, as Chris Friend framed it, quote, a sales transaction, end quote. Powerful examples of this discourse can be found, for instance, within the destructive Dear Student, Work Harder, and Broken System narratives that pit students, teachers, and publics against one another. These narratives are so problematic because they offer scapegoats that draw attention away from the ongoing erosion of state support, which has occasioned the legitimate anxiety students and teachers feel about their agency over how learning happens in classrooms. As operational costs of running and maintaining universities and schools have grown, administrators have turned towards selling off pieces of our educational systems. Some argue that schools have slowly and steadily improved, but for many, divestment from public education is at the heart of very real issues, ranging from the reliance on contingent labor to staff, courses, and the swelling transfer of the cost of education to students in the form of student debt, to the role that third-party testing and assessment services play within our schools and the rush to automate instruction through the use of educational technology. Of course, all of these issues deserve sustained critical attention, but this article is particularly concerned with the ways that uncritical adoption of educational technologies adversely impacts the autonomy of students and teachers within the shared enterprise of learning. Section 1. Interfaces and Agency. Across the 2 decades I've spent in higher education, I've watched certain technologies become a central component of how we enact education. Cell phones and email didn't meaningfully exist within my life as an undergraduate. Now, as a faculty member, I'm tethered to Gmail, Google Drive, Canvas, and Twitter for what seems like hundreds of hours a week. It often seems like a struggle to construct agency amidst the many technological interfaces, many that I haven't autonomously chosen for myself, that I encounter in both my scholarly and personal life. It is precisely this struggle that has drawn me to computers and writing, a field that has long attended to the nexus of interface, agency, and literacy. What I have to say about interface is deeply influenced by Anne Frances Wysocki and Julia Jaskin, Cindy and Dickie Self, Stuart Selber, J. Jeff Grable, Ellen Cushman, Doug Walls, Scott Chaupierre, Danielle Nicole DeVos, and Michelle W. Simmons, whose scholarship reveals how cultural, legal, political, social, and economic values are built into interfaces. Indeed, this body of scholarship might be read as examples of the different ways agency and power intersect within distinct contexts. Wysocki and Jaskin, for instance, observe that, quote, interfaces are about the relations we construct with each other, end quote. DePue and Lettner-Rust argue that, quote, interfaces mediate other power relations between instructors and students, end quote. Similarly, Sean Michael Morris and Jesse Stommel caution that educators might be uncritically relinquishing control of pedagogy to educational technologies such as learning management systems, and encourage educators to shift their stances to ensure, quote, pedagogy is driving functionality, end quote. However, a great deal of the political work that influences the shape of these interactions occurs beyond the screens. As Self and Self contend, interfaces are not merely neutral sites of exchange, but locations which reflect dominant power structures. They write, quote, borders are at least partly constructed along ideological axes that represent dominant tendencies in our culture. Borders evident in computer interfaces can be mapped as complex political landscapes. Borders can serve to prevent the circulation of individuals for political purposes, and teachers and students can learn to see and alter such borders in productive ways. End quote. What I find most inspiring about this scholarship is that it not only understands that interfaces are built to reflect values that circulate in social, political, and economic spheres, but also that interfaces are designed and built by people who have the agency to change them. Educational technologies, as interfaces, offer students and educators opportunities to discover and enact agency through strategic rhetorical action. Yet, realizing this agency is complex work because participating fully and meaningfully in the technological activities that comprise so many aspects of our social, civic, and professional lives requires an increasingly sophisticated array of multi-literacies. Selber's work on computers and literacy suggests that agency is realized through a blended repertoire of functional ways of doing, critical ways of knowing, and rhetorical ways of reflexively, ethically, and agentively combining functional ways of doing with critical ways of knowing. Agentive action not only requires a deep understanding of the value assumptions undergirding the technological interfaces we encounter, but also the technical and rhetorical prowess necessary for enacting changes to the ways we connect and relate at the moment of interfaces. Section 2. Values and Interfaces, What I Learned from Using Eli Review. To be clear, I'm not against buying and selling. This isn't an invective about whether or not commercial models are to be lauded or shamed or whether they have a place in education. Following Lawrence Lessig, I see value in both sharing and competitive economies because they have different motivational structures that incentivize different types of work and projects. For instance, there are commercial actors within rhetoric and composition like Bedford St. Martin's and Eli Review who add value to our field by employing scholars who participate within and enrich our disciplinary conversations, who listen and act transparently, and who make products and technologies that reflect pedagogy's our discipline values as sound and ethical. Eli Review, for instance, was designed by writing teachers who understand that writing is best taught as an iterative and social practice, and have built an interface that facilitates peer and teacher feedback within learning. They regularly host free teacher development workshops. Moreover, when I wanted to improve how I was using the tool in my own composition courses, Eli partnered me with their director of professional development, Melissa Meeks, who helped me redesign the prompts from the ground up and regularly met with me to check in on how things were going in the course. For me, this level of involvement was uncommon for an educational technology company. It suggested that Eli wasn't simply designed as a product for purchase, but as a technology with support mechanisms built into both their approach and interface. It was a technology that came with human support so that I could ensure that the tool helped me to scaffold the peer-to-peer and instructor-to-peer interactions that offer students generative experiences writing in our course. The challenge is that technology designers aren't always motivated by the same values or the right balance of values. Lessig argues that we must strike an ethical and sustainable balance with how we award ownership through copyright, because extending monopolistic control of ideas into perpetuity is neither good for innovation nor consistent with the aims of democracy. Yet, a great deal of research and scholarly knowledge produced within publicly funded universities is published within journals owned by commercial publishers such as Elsevier, which makes over $1 billion a year in profit. For Lessig, U.S. copyright wasn't designed as a mechanism to protect unfettered profiteering, but rather a legal protection that placed paramount value on the future accessibility and sustainability of scientific and artistic content, because of the central role such knowledge plays within a democracy. It's not surprising that Jeff Grable, one of the creators of Eli Review, posits that students would be well served by critical pedagogues who attend to the values that are instantiated within interfaces. Pointing toward the increasing role technologies play within learning environments, Grable carves a careful distinction between educational technologies, or technologies for, and learning technologies, or technologies with. He continues, "Technologies for automate teacher work. And if we had more time, I'd tell you about my decade of experience in the educational venture capital world, where they are out to replace you. They replace the teacher, focus on testing, focus on summative feedback, deprofessionalize teacher work, and they're free. I want to dwell for a minute on free. Academic humanists might be the last people in the world who believe there is something called free. There is no such thing as free. You're paying for your technology. You might be paying for it by making your students give up their personal data, or by giving up your own data, or you might be giving up technical or learning support, but you're paying for it. And one of the most insidious moves in educational technology in K-12 schools is the penchant for free on the surface, which costs them dearly downstream, particularly in the toll it takes on the lives of teachers and the lives of students. Through practices like mentoring, partnering, supporting, and being responsive, Eli Review has built an interface that informates what teachers and students do. It's supplemental, and it is designed to scaffold and enrich the agency that students and teachers have over the processes and products of their learning. Conversely, there are quote-unquote educational technologies designed to automate the work of teachers. For instance, iParadigms Turnitin employs a rhetoric of fear to turn educators away from, as Rebecca Moore Howard puts it, quote, pedagogy that joins teachers and students in the educational enterprise by choosing a machine that will separate them, end quote. But also leeches intellectual property that students create within educational systems, only to sell it back to schools. Unfortunately, PDS software like Turnitin has been so widely and uncritically adopted that members of the Conference on College Composition and Communication, the 4Cs, the world's largest professional organization for researching and teaching a composition, passed a formal resolution warning colleagues about the ways that PDS technologies compromise academic integrity during their 2013 meeting based on a position statement that the 4C's IP caucus had drafted. Section 3, Values and Interfaces, What I Learned About the Relationship Between ProQuest and Turnitin. A well-established body of scholarship within rhetoric and composition explores the ways PDS technologies violate student intellectual property and adversely position students and teachers. Moreover, PDS technologies just aren't capable of drawing nuanced decisions between actual plagiarism and the type of patch writing that commonly reflects a writer's learning how to master academic literacies like paraphrasing and using citation systems. Consequently, I was surprised when I learned through a series of Twitter conversations that a company that I respected and trusted, ProQuest, had an existing relationship whereby they provided Turnitin access to content in their databases. For a rich discussion of the history and argument surrounding PDS technology, see Turn It Down, Don't Turn It In, Resisting Plagiarism Detection Services by Teaching About Plagiarism Rhetorically by Stephanie Vai. In fact, I had recently provided ProQuest with access to my dissertation. As a member of the 4C IP caucus, I am ideologically opposed to Turn It In, and it upset me that this company might have access to my IP. Still, what really upset me was that the relationship wasn't made transparent when I interfaced with ProQuest's Electronic Theses and Dissertations, ETD, database. I understood that the Library of Congress and the University of Rhode Island, institutions I trust, value ProQuest because they made an important contribution to the progress of science and knowledge by curating their ETD repository. And because I trusted URI and the Library of Congress to bestow that responsibility with ProQuest, I in turn trusted ProQuest. I also understood, following the language in the University Agreement Statement, that I retain the rights and copyright for theses and dissertations produced as a part of a university degree, but that I had, quote, as a condition of the award of any degree, granted a royalty-free license or permission to the university and any outside sponsor, if appropriate, to reproduce, publicly display, on a non-commercial basis, copies of student dissertations, end quote. I've been revising portions of my dissertation for publication as articles and chapters, so I utilized the embargo option in order to protect my scholarship from the first publication clause. But after learning that ProQuest had potentially been sharing my intellectual property with a company that I disavow, I wanted to know more about how ProQuest grants Turnitin access to content in their database. I wrote to ProQuest and exchanged correspondence with a number of representatives. During my initial exchange, I learned that ProQuest considers Turnitin a third-party search engine, which I would argue is, at best, a disingenuous way of representing a PDS. They informed me that, quote, our records indicate that you did elect to allow third-party search engine access. However, you do have an embargo on your work since the time of submission. Therefore, your work would not have been supplied to Turnitin by ProQuest, end quote. Indeed, I did elect this understanding. ProQuest's interface suggested that doing so enables, quote, major search engines, e.g. Google or Yahoo, to discover my work through ProQuest, end quote. As I continued to correspond with various representatives, I was informed that ProQuest, quote, had not distributed my manuscript to any third-party indexer, end quote. Since that time, ProQuest has authored more substantive clarifying language regarding their partnership with iParadigm, Turnitin, iThenticate. Yet, these statements are not built into the actual interface students navigate to make agentive decisions regarding how they share their content. Moreover, some institutions unilaterally compel students to submit work to Turnitin, iThenticate as a condition of granting a degree, rather than trusting students and their advisors to produce and ensure the veracity and originality of scholarship. I'm thankful that the graduate school at URI did not take this stance while I was still there. Still, I continue to be concerned about this tweet that Turnitin posted on 8 March 2012. Quote, retweet, iThenticate. 300,000 dissertations and theses from @ProQuest added to @Turnitin and @iThenticate database. Hashtag hired ed, end quote. As this tweet and a press release from 12 March 2012 seem to suggest, it appears that ProQuest has offered Turnitin access to their database. So which is it? Were the authors who uploaded their IP to the ProQuest repository prior to the formation of the ProQuest Turnitin partnership consulted about whether they had assented to share their IP with this third party? Has Turnitin, iParadigm's iAuthenticate index works which they should not have access to? Interfacing with this technology makes me curious about whether student authors have agency over who accesses their work and how others might profit from labor that takes place in publicly funded institutions. Examining ProQuest in relationship to the Vanderhei ruling, which held iParadigm's indexing was legal under fair use provisions of copyright law, there are notable distinctions to be drawn. Specifically, the ProQuest interface does not make it transparent that copyright holders may be sharing their IP with iParadigms, nor have copyright holders entered into the same legal agreement as students in the Vanderhyde cases when they clicked I agree and actively uploaded their content, in turn providing the indexical database access to their intellectual property. Even if fair use doctrine protects the transformative uses of content such as indexing, companies like Google offer insights into how agency might be returned to creators who wish to uphold their moral rights. Quote, even though the Copyright Act does not grant a copyright owner a veto over such uses, it is our policy to allow any rights holder to remove their content from our index, end quote. This policy statement reflects that Google's stance is that they seek to affirm ultimately the agency of creators. By adopting a shift in stance towards how PDSs are implemented, educators could work towards affirming the agency of student creators. Rather than using coercive power to force students to submit to PDSs, educators could offer the service to students who wish to use it. Similarly, PDSs could follow Google's approach by allowing creators to remove content that has been indexed. Offering opt-in and opt-out mechanisms to student creators demonstrates respect for their decision-making capacity as humans. If the purpose of education is to serve humanist and civic aims, critical pedagogues must work to ensure that the structures through which it is enacted, institutions, classrooms, technologies, databases, should empower the people those structures were designed to serve. Critical pedagogy is about ensuring that learning is grounded in an ethic that serves humanist aims and enriches our communal, civic well-being. It creates and protects places where hybridic ways of being, knowing, and doing are possible. Through tactical action, critical pedagogues might adapt how they relate with students during moments of interface, but they must also attend to the ways that pedagogical interface is distributed to educational technologies. Critical pedagogues must work to ensure that the technologies that serve us serve our aims.
That was Disowning Tech, originally published on the 8th of September, 2016, on Hybrid Pedagogy. It was written by Timothy R. Amidon. Tim is an associate professor at Colorado State University. He studies writing, professional and technical communication, and digital rhetoric, particularly intellectual property, multimodal literacies, and communication design. Well, that's it for this episode. Next time, you'll hear Education as Bulwark of Uselessness by Luca Marini. This serialized audiobook version of Hybrid Teaching, Pedagogy, People, Politics is available wherever you find podcasts. I'm Chris Friend, collection editor, podcast producer, and host. I tweet at Chris_Friend and teach at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. The theme music for this project is Where Was I? From Lee Rosevere. That song, as well as the text and audio of Hybrid Teaching, are all licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, which means they can be reused with author acknowledgement. Licenses like these make multimedia works like this simpler to create, and I'm especially grateful to each of the authors for allowing their material to be reused in this format. And I'm also grateful to you. Thanks for listening.